The Oldie Lunch Recordings presents Tom Bauer talking about Tony Blair in his book Broken Vows, which is sponsored by Noble Caledonia, the world experts in small ship cruising.
As our politics lie in shambles, my aging brain increasingly rambles. What is a solution? I nearly bring my lunch up, reading about the alleged UKIP punch-up. As PM, Mother Teresa steers her ship, and Jerry moves on in his 70s time slip. What is the answer? The initials TB, once meant a scourge. They still do, it seems to me. Not the initials of our author, I hasten to add, who writes of a world both complex and mad. No, the other TB, apparently a saviour, a second coming. If he's the answer, let's not go slumming. Enough. Now is the man, now is the hour. He writes of power. Welcome our author, Tom Bauer.
Good afternoon. Well, I've never had such a fine introduction. Thank you very much. Well, unlike my other two friends here who've written fine books about people who are dead, I only write about the living. My whole ambition in life is to ask why the buggers are lying to me. My 22 books, this is the 22nd book, have always taken people who have climbed the greasy pole, and on the way up, they have inevitably caused many casualties, and then to stay on top, they cause even more. And my great secret, which I'll share with you, is to find their victims, to tell the real story about how they got to the top and how they have stayed there. So, for example, with Robert Maxwell, I predicted in 1988 that he was a crook and that bad things would happen to him. He sued me 11 times, and he fell off his boat and died. With Richard Branson, I said he was a crook, and to my great glee, he was denied, in one of my great triumphs, he was denied the National Lottery and said that my book was the foulest piece of writing he'd ever read. And that went on very prominently on the back of the paperback. With Gordon Brown, I predicted when I wrote about him in 2004 that he was completely mad and no one took any notice. And so I got quite excited because in the book I said that he had constantly was championing Africa, but had never been there. Within days of the book appearing, the Chancellor of the Exchequer announced that he was taking a business trip with 20 or 30 businessmen on a special aircraft to tour Africa. So I wrote in the Daily Mail, well, he may be going to Africa, but he's never been to China. Days later, a business trip was announced to follow the one from Africa to China. And now I was slightly perplexed. So I then wrote another piece in the Daily Mail saying, our Chancellor has never been to the moon. Now, with Tony Blair, like all these books, they started with a quest to understand. I couldn't understand what he'd actually achieved. And one of the great achievements, which everyone said, was that he had an amazing relationship with the royal family. He wrote about it himself, that he was a great supporter of Diana. After all, he made his name with the people's princess. And in his memoirs, he wrote that when he had entertained her to Chequers, in the last weeks of her life, he had warned her that she should not get too close to Dodi. Mohammed Fayed, another of my great conquests, and I've got the scars to show it, and certainly the bunny rabbit too, which he gave me in those of the good times before he decided he didn't like me, was about to cause her great grief, Blair said to Princess Diana, allegedly. Because if you look at the date that she actually went to Chequers, she hadn't yet met Dodi Fayed. So when I say why the bugger's lying to me, that is one of the issues. Now, one of the great geniuses of Tony Blair was, and remains, that he knows exactly what his audience wants to hear. So, for example, in the simplest way, he was asked at the time of one Labour conference in Blackpool or Brighton, one of those places, what was his favourite meal? And he said, fish and chips, collected in a newspaper from the local shippy. At that very moment, in the local Islington paper where he lived, he was asked to write what was his favorite recipe and meal. And he told the Islington cookbook that his preferred meal was fresh fettuccine garnished with an exotic sauce of olive oil, sun-dried tomatoes, and capers. Now that, of course, is New Labour's skill. They find out what you wanted, and then they offered it to you. The great problem is they didn't deliver. And that is really what my book is about. It started, as many books do, with a great argument. It was an argument in Hampstead at a dinner party with friends and a very close friend of the Blairs. And she said that he had been an amazing success in that period with education. Education, education, education. And I said I didn't believe that. I thought education standards had fallen during the Labour period. Well, this argument went on for some days, and I suddenly realised that there had been at least 30, if not 40, books by the Blairites extolling their genius. Blair, Blunkett, Darling, Campbell, Endless Diaries, Mandelson, everything. But no one actually had done it from the other side. What actually did they achieve? So I set out to actually find out. And what I did was I decided to look for all the civil servants who had worked in those 10 years in the Blair White, in Blair's Whitehall. And I chose five departments: health, education, immigration, energy, and the wars. And I got a researcher who then found out each of the civil servants in each of these departments and systematically interviewed them to find out what they had personally eyewitnessed in those 10 years. And of course, each of them only knew a little bit, but putting it all together, one got the pattern. And it was very different to what we all imagined. I then went to the most senior civil servants, the cabinet secretaries, the permanent secretaries, then the ministers, the junior ministers, the cabinet ministers. But the only thing person I didn't bother to even ask to talk to was Tony Blair. Because, of course, I had his book. And that was just filled with the most wonderful fantasies. And it served my purpose very well. Now, one of the great symbols of Thatcherism is Canary Wharf. At the moment, it still has got about 120,000 people there. And it was a conversion of this derelict shipyard, a dockyard, into the center of global finance. That symbolized Thatcherism, the idealism, the ideology of Thatcherism. Now, the ideology of Blairism and Blair is, of course, the tent at the dome on the Isle of Dogs, the scene of the most dreadful millennium party, where the Queen looks as if she really is most miserable, and that shows the truth, and no one knew what to do with it. So Blairism, and that is what's so extraordinarily interesting about this 10 years, this great phenomenal success, three election successes and all the rest, that no one actually says we want to return to Blairism. There are no Blairites anymore. There are Thatcherites. There are even Marxists, but no Blairites. Now, why did it all go so wrong? And my explanation in the book and my discovery is that he was terrific with words. He promised modernization, but it was modernization without a purpose. He promised to revolutionize the health service, and yet the health service, at the end, the budget went up 300%. But actually, productivity fell, and the problems increased. And that was partly because Tony Blair never understood to ask the one simple question, I want value for money. In immigration, I discovered going through the Home Office, all the civil servants there, that Tony Blair, when Jack Straw arrived as the Home Secretary, he told the civil servants, Tony is not interested in immigration. The only thing he wanted to do was to remove the primary purpose rule, which admitted round about 150,000 dependents from the subcontinent to Britain every year. But the rest of that, the rest of the asylum seekers grew and everything else grew because he was persuaded by Gordon Brown that to talk about immigration was racist and played the Tory card. So within 2 years, 500,000 extra people arriving in Britain every year. But because it couldn't be discussed, there could be no provision for extra homes, schools, hospitals, and the rest. And the consequence is one of the problems we are faced with today. And so we get to the wars. And in this, I think is one of the biggest contributions I make. It was a book that I think is, as somebody here came up to me and said, he read the book and he was very pleased because he thought it was a page turner. But when you get to the story of the wars, it is really not only a page turner, but also quite horrendous. Because you see, one of the great weaknesses and great corruptions of the Blairite era was that he completely corrupted the process of government. Now, this may be an oldie lunch, but I'm sure all of you want to understand what I mean by this, because we are living with the legacy of that today. What he did was he resorted to abolish what are known as cabinet committees, to have sofa government, to have everything dealt with in his den with his cronies. And as a result of that, he got three definite benefits in his point of view. First of all, he excluded Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown was not only his greatest enemy, but also the saboteur of the Blair government, a man who was only interested in one thing, which was to remove Tony Blair and sabotage every policy just to achieve that. Secondly, he got secrecy. And thirdly, he pursued an agenda which was in his interest, but not in the country's. Now, one of the great mysteries of that era is how the media, and I include myself in that, were prepared to accept the lies of Alistair Campbell and the rest, what we called genuinely and generously spin, but in fact were just outright lies. And so what we now believe to be the lie of the Iraq war, the book shows it wasn't an aberration. It was not something that's happened out of the blue. He'd been lying about health, about education, about energy, immigration, and many other topics all the way until the outbreak of the war with the dodgy dossier. Now, the war does not start because of Saddam in 2003. It starts very soon after 9/11, when the towers are blown up by the suicide pilots in New York. Within 2 months, Tony Blair had said to George Bush that he wanted to join the invasion of Iraq. But he had one major problem, and this is what the book brings out, which Chilcot refused to bring out, because Chilcot, in the end, was an establishment arrangement to have a whitewash. What he even collected the evidence, Chilcot, but refused to come to the conclusion. George Bush was empowered by Congress to remove Saddam Hussein. Tony Blair did not have the power to have regime change. The only way he could join the war with Bush was to say that Saddam was not obeying UN resolutions about the destruction of his WMDs, the weapons of mass destruction. He only had one problem in 2001, and that was that Saddam had destroyed his WMDs in 1991. So he had to corrupt and accept the corrupt intelligence reports that Saddam had WMDs. Now, it's not the moment now to go into the detail how that was done. But suffice to say that we got to this extraordinary situation when he wrote and published that extraordinary dossier in September 2002, saying that we were 45 minutes away from destruction and that Saddam had all these extraordinary weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, and chemical. He believed the intelligence services' reports. And the intelligence services themselves believed it. And the reason is simply this. They had become so corrupted by the nature that there was no criticism within the British government system, no scrutiny of what they were delivering, that they accepted the rules and they accepted the intelligence of people who were deliberately lying. Now, this is one classic example of how we still haven't overcome the legacy of Blair. Chilcot brings it out. I tell it in the book, but there's one element I didn't realize, and it's this. On the eve of Tony Blair publishing that dodgy dossier, he called in Richard Dearlove, the head of MI6, and said, "Are you sure that Saddam has got WMDs?" "Yes," says Dearlove, "and more to the point, I can bring an MI6 officer who's got brand new intelligence to confirm it." In he comes at number 10. Now, at this stage, there is a fundamental cancer within British government, because until that moment, until the Blair government, it was impossible for the heads of intelligence agencies to meet the Prime Minister without the Cabinet Secretary being present. The Cabinet Secretary was present for one reason only. He was there to take the Prime Minister by the elbow and say, "Prime Minister, do remember, intelligence comes from traitors, criminals, fabricators, and fantasists. But Blair had abolished the presence of the cabinet secretary because he wanted to hear by himself, and he wanted a relationship with Dear Love and the others which was not be corrupted by the presence of the, and the objective corruption of the presence of the cabinet secretary. Dear Love assures Blair in September 2002 that Saddam has WMDs. By April 2002, just after the war, Dear Love knows, the head of MI6, that that intelligence was a fabrication. It was a fantasy. The man who gave it to MI6 did it for money. In July of that year, he submits to Blair his annual report. In the annual report, he says that all the intelligence WMDs, and this is now 4 months after the war, was accurate, and we've proven to be accurate. He already knew it was inaccurate, but he kept quiet. Blair only discovered that the intelligence was untrue the following year, towards the end of 2004, as a result of a report called the Butler Report into the Failures of Intelligence, which itself, again, was a convoluted whitewash to protect Blair. So the result of that system of government, of the dishonesty of Tony Blair, and believe me, I don't come to that conclusion without having spent a lot of time talking to the people by analysing the evidence of the rest, is one small example that we went to war on the basis of dishonest intelligence, but the system encouraged it to happen. Now, what is one legacy of that dishonesty? It was the Afghan War. Afghanistan was meant to be nation building. You will remember, perhaps, John Reid, the Secretary of State for Defense, going onto the streets, into Parliament, and saying, we hope the troops will return without a shot being fired in anger. They went there with just the same failings as the war in Iraq. Inadequate intelligence, inadequate equipment, and a tiny military force that couldn't do the job. As a result, 468 British soldiers died. It cost hundreds of soldiers their limbs, and £38 billion. And today, in the newspapers, they report that Helmand province is about to fall again to the Taliban. It was a scandal. And that was the result of the Tony Blair corruption of our government and the military services too. Now, what is extraordinary about Tony Blair is that he has, on the whole, got away with it. He is not loved, and yet, when he left government, he did one particular thing. He said that he wanted nearly a year to establish his legacy. Most people think the legacy comes while you're in government, not the deliberate contrivance of the legacy in the last year. But having spent 10 years sacrificing British lives, British money, British reputation on fighting dictators, he then immediately goes and takes jobs to service the dictators. So you have to ask yourself, who was the real Tony Blair? And the book seeks to answer that. Because the one thing about Tony Blair is he did make a difference. The problem is he made the wrong difference. And what we're living with at the moment is this attempt to understand what went wrong. Now, one of the, and I will conclude with this, Tony Blair was not a man with much self-awareness. He wasn't a man who really suffered self-criticism. He wasn't a man to suffer many doubts. But when he became Prime Minister, he realized that he had one major weakness, and that was that he was intelligent but was uneducated. He had never read any history books. He had never understood how does government work. So he called up Roy Jenkins and explained his problem. And Roy said, don't worry, I'll educate you. And a few days later, five books arrived, history books, at Downing Street. Four of them were by Roy Jenkins. Now, one of those books, which Tony Blair definitely read, was the biography of Gladstone. And now you understand one thing. You may have read that in Esquire magazine that Tony Blair is now dreaming of the return of the resurrection. After all, he thinks to himself, I won three elections. It might have been because of a weak Tory opposition, but I won three. Corbyn's going to get defeated. They will need me. Now, you may think, where does the man get the cheek to think that he will be summoned to rebuild Labour? And that is the one lesson he learned from the Gladstone biography. At the age of 84, he could still be Prime Minister, perhaps. And that is really the bankruptcy of our political situation now on the left, that they have no ideology, they have a fractious party, they have no successor to Blair. They have no successor, more importantly, to Harold Wilson and Callaghan and those people who, whatever you think of their politics, were nevertheless substantial people. He wrecked the Labour Party. He was not a great asset to the Britain itself. And what this book does is, for the first time, it actually challenges the myth of New Labour. And therefore, thank you very much for coming. And that's it. Thanks.
For more information about the Oldie magazine and Belunches, go to theoldie.co.uk. Produced by RadioGorgeous.com.